Chapter 33 Grand Hotel Beauvau. An hour later, freshly showered and enjoying their second room service Bombay Sapphire Gibson, Sam and Remy sat on their balcony and looked out over the viewport. The lights of the city reflected off the water's surface in a mosaic of red, yellow, and blue that slowly rippled with the falling rain. In the distance they could hear the mournful howl of a foghorn, and closer in the occasional clang of a buoy. The phone trilled. Sam checked the screen. It was Rube. As soon as they got back to the hotel, he had called Haywood, given him a purposely vague recounting of the night's events, and asked him to call back. Sam closed the balcony door, then answered and put the phone on speaker. Rube, please tell us Kolkov and his merry band are in custody.
Sorry, no. The French DCPJ can't find them.
Wish I could say I was surprised.
Me too. Ready to quit and come home now?
Not in your life.
Remy?
No chance.
Well, on the bright side, Kolkov's name and picture are everywhere. If he tries to leave the country through an airport, port, or train station, they'll pick him up.
Then again, Sam said, from what you told me, it sounds like the Spetsnaz are trained to slip across borders. And he doesn't strike me as stupid enough to walk into an airport.
True.
What about Bondaruk? Remy asked. Any chance of digging into his family's skeleton closet and figuring out what's driving him?
Possibly. It turns out the Iranian Pazdaran colonel who was Bondaruk's handler during the border war ran into some trouble with the Ayatollah a few years later. We're not sure what the rigmarole was about, but the colonel, his name was Aref Ghassemi, escaped to London and started working for the British. He's still there. I've got someone reaching out to him.
Thanks, Rube, Remy said, and hung up. The next morning they slept in until 9 and had breakfast on the balcony. The previous night's rain had disappeared, leaving behind a blue sky with scattered cotton puff clouds. Over coffee, they called Selma, who was awake despite it being nearly midnight in California. As far as they could tell, their chief researcher slept only 5 or so hours a night, but never seemed the worse for it. Leaving out the finer details, Sam told her about finding the Chateau d'If hiding place empty. Remy added, the cicada was there, though, and it looked like a perfect match for Laurent's chisel stamp.
That's better than nothing, Selma said. I'm making some headway on deciphering lines 3 and 4 on the bottle, but as for the rest, zilch. And I think I know why. There is a third key.
Explain, Sam said.
Laurent's book is one key, and the bottle we have is another. At least, the first 4 lines are. I'm guessing the third key is another bottle. We need all 3 to cross-reference and decode the rest of the lines.
This feels convoluted, Remy said.
From our perspective, maybe, but we've got to make some assumptions. First, that Laurent intended to hide the 12 bottles from the original case individually, at scattered locations. He's arrows on a map to whatever's at the end of all this.
We need to find a name for this thing, Sam said.
Napoleon's gold,
Remy suggested with a shrug. Works for me. Selma said, okay, Napoleon's gold.
I suspect he meant it to work like this. Find 1 bottle, decode it with the book, then follow the riddle to another bottle.
Sam caught on. Then use that label's code with the book and the first bottle to decode the next line.
And its riddle, which leads to yet another bottle, and so forth. The good news is, and this is another guess, I don't think there's any sequence to the code. In other words, Laurent designed it so any bottle would lead to another riddle.
Remy said, if all this is right, why did he hide 3 bottles together at D'If?
No idea. We might find out down the road.
We're ignoring the elephant in the room, Sam said. We know for sure 1 of the bottles is lost. The shard from the Pocomoke proves that.
Without that bottle, we could be missing the last riddle, the one that points us to Napoleon's gold.
I was thinking the same thing, Remy replied. I guess we won't know until we reach the end.
Selma, what are the chances the bottle Kolkoff recovered in Rum Key is doing them any good? Sam asked.
Slim. Unless they have a code book, that is. And based on how he's been on your heels every step of the way, I'd say they're lost.
Here's elephant number two, Remy said. At some point, we're going to have to get our hands on a Rum Key bottle.
Which means, Sam said, a trip into the lion's den.
Sevastopol. 2,000 miles east of Marseille, Hadion Bondaruk sat at his desk, hands clasped before him. Spread across the burgundy leather blotter were a dozen high-resolution color photographs, each one highlighting a separate line of symbols. For the 10th time in an hour, he picked up a lighted magnifying glass and studied each photo in turn, focusing on the minute details of every symbol. The right angle of this square, the looping curve of a truncated omega, the tilt of a crescent moon. Nothing. There was nothing. He tossed the magnifying glass across the desk, then swept his arm over the surface, scattering the photos. Despite its monetary value, alone the bottle was worthless to him, and now that the Fargos had Arnaud Laurent's book, he had to assume they would quickly begin to unravel the code. As much as he wanted to blame Kolkoff for the book's loss, Bondaruk had to admit he'd also underestimated the Fargos. They were treasure hunters, adventurers. Neither he nor Kolkoff had anticipated they would be this much trouble, or this resourceful. Perhaps they should have foreseen this. After all, it stood to reason the Fargos' escapades had landed them in enough dicey situations to have seasoned them. Still, their resources couldn't hope to match his own. On Napoleon alone, he'd spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. His researchers had dissected the man's life from cradle to grave, had tracked down not only his every known descendant, but those of the dozens of friends and advisors and lovers Napoleon might have confided in, Arnaud Laurent included. Every book written about Napoleon had been scanned into their computer database and parsed for clues. Period artwork, from battle scenes to portraits to rough sketches, had been scoured for anything that might point the way. A symbol on a tunic button, a finger pointing at something in the background, a book on a shelf behind Napoleon's head. And for all that, for all the money spent and time wasted, he had nothing but a useless bottle of wine and a pictograph of a damned insect. His desk phone chimed and he picked it up.
It's me, Vladimir Kolkoff said. Where have you been? Bondaruk growled. I was expecting your call last night. Tell me what's happening.
We tracked them to Marseille yesterday afternoon. I met them and proposed a truce and a partnership.
You what?
I didn't tell you to do that.
Proposing a truce and keeping a truce are two different things, Mr. Bondaruk.
At any rate, they didn't budge.
Where are they now?
Back in Marseille.
Back? What does that mean?
I had to leave France. I'm in La Jonquera, on the other side of the Spanish border. The French police are looking for me. Someone put out a bulletin.
The Fargos. It has to be.
How would they do that?
I'm looking into it.
It doesn't matter. If they leave, I'll know it.
How?
Kolkoff explained, and Bondaruk said, What about the book?
I had a man watching their house, but Fargo wasn't bluffing. They've got security. I think it would cause more trouble than it's worth. And since we'll know where they're going and when, we can let them do the hard work for us.
Agreed.
Bondaruk hung up, strode to his window, and forced himself to take a calming breath. Kolkoff was right. There was still time. The Fargos were ahead,
but they had a long way to go and many hurdles to clear before they reached the end. Sooner or later, they would make a mistake. When they did, Kolkov would be there.